Welcome to the audiographically attenuated Sojcast. It has been advanced by some of our listeners that there's no way for them to tell us apart. And so rather than go with a ridiculous accent, we figured instead to f*** around with the soundboard.
Number 75.
Number 75.
Emasculated duck.
So, Dion, can you hear me?
In Australia.
Can you tell us apart now?
Is there any way imaginable to distinguish between the sounds of our disparate voices?
None whatsoever.
Our cackling sounds exactly the same.
I sound like I'm surrounded by a legion of demons, and it's making me sound like
I'm in a bad horror movie. I would like it to stop now. It's making me uncomfortable.
It's freaking me out!
Welcome to the Sojcast. I'm Mark Austin.
And I'm Stacey Roberts.
And we are the Sons of Joy. You're listening to Sojcast number 20.
Our 20th ever Sojcast.
Today's Sojcast is sponsored by Strange Voices.
Makers of Being Committed to a Mental Institution.
Sudden Real Estate Listings.
And Emasculated Ducks.
Well, I don't know if there's anything else to say about our, what's clearly going to go down as our wackiest intro ever.
Yes, that was quite fun. And for those of you who listen religiously to every Sojcast and our guest appearances, the whole notion of not being able to tell us apart was first advanced by the kind ladies of Tweeb Nation.
Oh, it was first advanced by our mothers, but
oh yes,
that was years before.
Yes, well, we thought that, like most things, they were just kidding around. Because they were comic geniuses, those women. But the real comic geniuses that we met only recently, Amber and Dion of Tweep Nation, also said they couldn't tell us apart, but I think they were struggling to care which one of us was talking.
That's the more difficult proposition
yes.
to solve, really.
So we thought, since we do have a high-tech audio board, that we would just turn some dials at random and see what happens. And apparently, it sounded a great deal like a duck whose nuts had been chopped off.
Or a number of dwarfs who are lamenting the loss of poor Pippin. If you've never joined us before, you're probably wondering what the hell you've gotten yourself into.
But this is where I would remind you that it's time for you to go back and listen to all the previous Sojcasts. And
there's 19 of them.
Yes, and a guest appearance on Tweep Nation. So it's a lot to keep track of, and you better go get caught up. We'll wait.
So it feels like we're behind. We were supposed to, well, I traveled last week. And we were going to get what would have been Sojcast 20 out, but we had some technical problems.
Yes.
Apparently the celluloid tape that we used caught on fire and was burned, and we weren't able to recover any of it.
Yes.
So whatever things we said, you won't get back.
I think that was the excuse for a reason we didn't go to production with our Sojcast back in 1981.
It's still a good reason.
Well, everybody listening has certainly fallen for it.
Fire is dangerous.
But here we are.
So what all happened while I was away?
Well, and this will come as a great shock to everyone. I took care of your dog.
That's true.
Yes. And
Kodos.
Yes, your dog Kodos and her expressive anal gland. It's a joy for everyone to behold.
But apparently, she instead of the last time you watched her, she expressed her anal gland on you. But I understand this time you got something from the other end.
Oh, yes. The sneezer. We'll have to put a picture of Kodos up on the page, but she has got probably 4 or 5 dogs worth of lip.
Oh, yeah. She has a giant head.
Yes, and she was sitting on the couch, the dog couch, which I have a couch dedicated just for dogs now, which is proof to everyone of how low I have fallen from my vaunted station. But she was sitting on the dog couch, and then it looked like she was going to bite someone's head off. All those lips, they flap back like the opening of a domed stadium. And you could only see, like, the slits of her eyes and this gigantic heaving mess.
It's a maw, really.
Yes, and then her head exploded in what we can only determine to be a sneeze. And we laughed so hard, and the children ran to get Pepper, because we wanted to try this again, and everybody had their iPhones out, and we just couldn't get enough footage, so our listeners will be deprived of the footage, but I can tell you that the sneezer was a highlight of your absence.
The Kodos sneezer. I've seen it. It is quite a sight to behold.
And the dog, of course, is sneezing her head off, and she doesn't understand what's going on, and she's like, why aren't you helping me? Why are you just standing there laughing at me?
Well, that's the way of dogs. Mm-hmm. So while this was all going on, apparently I was in Seattle, or Redmond, depending on which day it was. And there wasn't all that much exciting to report, because it was just a lot of work. But one of the things I thought was kind of funny that we might talk about was we had a team building event. And I know you work in a small office, and so you don't do a lot of corporate culture things here.
Like team building events.
Like team building events. Although you have done team building events in the past, I remember years ago, there were a few. Involved a comedy club or something.
Yes, but I think that, it turned out to be just a rather transparent excuse for us to all go out drinking together and be embarrassing.
That's how they're supposed to work out. In fact, this might have been one of those events. So the team building event was at a cooking school. And I would use the term with finger quotes if we could convey that through an audio sidecast somehow.
Seriously, folks, he's using finger quotes. Take my word for it.
Finger quotes. Because it was a very small, I mean, it's one room where there's a stove or two, and a refrigerator. It's, it's no more than your average storefront. So calling it a school, I mean, you're not thinking like anything the size of your elementary school, unless you went to a Little House on the Prairie school, that kind of smallness. But anyway, the point wasn't so much that we were at cooking school to learn anything because, well, they didn't teach us anything. Instead, they, scheduled a series of contests, if you will, and then some trivia contest, and then...
Was the trivia was food-based?
It was food-based, yeah. Okay. And then eventually we ended up cooking, but the thing was, I'm a big fan of context. I like to understand, what's going on? What's happening around me?
What do these mashed potatoes mean?
Is this all a boot, as the Canadians would say? And so there wasn't really any sort of context except we're going there. They said we couldn't touch the knives we couldn't touch the wine until after we had finished with the knives. So I knew there was wine involved somehow.
Yeah, okay.
And knives, obviously.
These sounds like rules at a preschool.
Yes, well, if there's drinking at your preschool, you might want to check with the state.
Yes, don't touch the knives until you've had your wine, children. Wait, no.
Oh, boy. We kind of got in there. They gave us name tags. We stuck them on our shirts, and then it turned out the name tags were color-coded, and so you found people with the same color as your name, which would have been tough in your case, as they were not ones easily identifiable by the colorblind. And you teamed up. And so, I was on a team. Charles was on a different team. And there were four teams in total all going around doing things. So the first they just cordoned us off into our teams and then said, team, nominate someone and send them up here. And which most teams said, for what? We have many people with different skills. Perhaps we could send the best person for the job.
This is a point I guess I would make is that we're talking about a pretty high-level team at Microsoft.
Yeah, this isn't an entry-level team.
Right, true. I mean, so we're talking some pretty good brains and problem solvers and troubleshooters. And so vague instructions like, don't touch the wine until you've used the knives. I have that backwards.
No, that's right.
Yeah, so no wine before knives, I guess. That's a pretty specific contextual instruction. Nominate someone to come up here for an undefined purpose, which they will find out when they arrive. I don't think that's going to work on big brain troubleshooting problem solvers.
Well, that's all we had to go on. So it turned out I was sent up first, being the, the most versatile, I suppose, and closest to the front. The first event was the peeling of an apple. So they said, you have an apple and a knife in front of you. And you can, your goal is to peel the apple, and whoever has the longest peel, presumably you're going to go in a spiral, or you're going to have a very short peel, wins. And so actually I was up there with Charles and two other people, And they said, all right, so go. And so we just started, you know, whittling away at the apple. And this is, they said this was not a timed event. So, you know, you can be as precise as you feel like you need to be. And so everybody finished except me. And I was about halfway through my apple when they said, how's it going? I said, yeah, about halfway. Why do you ask? Yeah, I heard it was not a timed event. And they go, it's not, but everybody is waiting.
Which makes it suddenly a timed event. If driven by nothing than the impatience of other people.
I'm like, well, I know it's a 3-hour event, so I figure I've got at least 3 hours to finish my apple.
Unless you all have some more activities in mind.
So I hurried to finish my apple, and for the record, Charles won. He had the longest, continuous peel. Now I didn't know that was also part of it, because my peel broke in several places because it was quite thin. And so I say for the record, I had the longest one, but I didn't have the one that was still all in one piece.
Are we feeling fortunate this is not a call-in show? Because I think Charles would be hammering on the Skype right now.
No, he won. He knows he won. He got the points for it.
Yes, but it sounds like you maybe are contesting it based on the length of peel.
Oh, no. I just can't glue it all back together, so it just doesn't count.
All right.
As they were measuring off the peels and gabbing on about whatever was going to happen next, I still had a peeled apple and a knife in my hand, so I started to eat my apple. You know, just cutting off little slices and munching on it as they're talking. And they're like, hey, you can't eat that apple. I'm like, you gave me an apple and a knife. I don't know what you thought was going to happen here, but I'm eating this apple.
Yes,
like,
I wasn't.
We need that for the apple pie.
I wasn't about to offer it to some half-naked woman in the Garden of Eden, thereby resulting in a sin to haunt all mankind.
No, you need skin for those.
I figured as much.
Yeah, so apparently this was an apple that was demarked for some later purpose, but again, without context.
Ah. Well, hold on, because as a frequent watcher of the Food Network, I can tell you that as a contestant on any kind of competitive cooking show, it is a huge faux pas to eat the food that you're making, other than the required tasting it. Right?
Oh, yes.
Because there was a recent Iron Chef competition in which one of the contestants was given a bunch of ingredients to grill out. And so he grilled a steak, and then while everything else he was doing was cooking, he ate the steak, and the judges were incensed. And so I can understand why these people were mad at you.
Yes, but he might have known that the steak was for someone else. I didn't know that my apple had any other purpose except for this contest. I thought it was the remains of a contest. I didn't realize that we were being their prep chef, their mise en place. Or
perhaps
whatever.
They should have been more clear.
I say, big fan of, you know, understanding context of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a couple other contests. Forget what the... there was a slicing of a strawberry, and they counted how many slices you could get and how well it spread. Without any instruction. So if you were good at that before you got there, perhaps you would win. And then the final of the first set of contests was the whipping of cream, which everyone had, the whole team participated in. Everybody took 10 seconds and then switched. And then the next person would come in and whip for 10 seconds. And the first team that was willing to hold the bowl over their head, and presumably, they, again, not very clear on whether or not it should fall on your head, they didn't say that, but the first team to put the bowl over their head won, and I put the bowl over my head. And no one could really tell if whipped cream fell on my head, because my hair is white, and so we won that contest. And then we started into, then there was a trivia contest.
Well, and see, again, this is where I wish this was a call-in show, because I'd like someone to call in and tell me at what point the team building was going to begin. You all whipped cream together. Big whoop.
Well, we did whipped cream. That's true. Well, and then the teams were set about to cooking stations to, I'm not sure cook is the right word, but to kind of help prep stuff a little bit. So we ended up at our team was at the mashed potato station first. And so we got there. It was the first step. So there was a big pot of hot potatoes that had been boiled. There was a ricer. There was a garlic crusher or a little garlic press. There was some garlic. There was some gerbil.
I don't even know what that is. Is that gerbil food?
No, gerbil. Well, you could probably feed gerbil to a gerbil. Gerbil is French parsley.
Oh boy!
So it's parsley. It's a garnish, and that's about it. Butter. Yeah, obviously there had to be some butter somewhere. Half the team set about ricing the potatoes, which one of them had a ricer at home, so they were quite familiar with that, which was good. And, the, the matronly chef lady said to me, I want you to some garlic.
This is the lady who's in charge of this cooking school?
She actually was in charge of the cooking school, yes.
Okay, all right.
But there were a number of stations. She just happened to be at the one we were at first. And she said, can you, mince up some garlic, however you want to do that, and, put as much garlic as you like in there for the mashed potatoes. So I cut up maybe 4 cloves, the individual nuggets, 4 pieces of garlic, and I minced them up pretty good, and I put them in a bowl. And she said, don't you think you need a little more garlic? And I said, no, this looks quite fine for me. Like, this is an appropriate amount of garlic in my opinion. And she said, no, you need more garlic. I said, you said put in as much as you wanted. Now, is this the cook the way you enjoy eating school, or is this the do as we say school? At which point she turned kind of red and we didn't get along after that.
So your team building exercise with her was an abject failure.
Oh yeah. Well, luckily she doesn't work for Microsoft.
That is fortunate.
Yeah. So again, without a context, if you come here and say, follow the recipe precisely because that's what we need you to do. I might have been inclined to do that, but you said make it the way you wanted, so I did. And then she said, all right, fine, chop up the chervil. Not the gerbil.
You had to catch him first, then chop him up.
And so, I took the parsley and I folded it and I rolled it and I had a nice little bundle like they would do in cooking school. And I rough chopped it and then I fine chopped a corner and I put it in the bowl. And she said, that needs to be chopped finer. I said, but I like rough cut. She goes, but it needs to be chopped finer. So again, at the militant Nazi school of doing as we say, I was not doing well. I said, so you're not a fan of rustic potatoes is what I'm hearing. At which point she didn't even answer.
Wow, you're not good at all at team building exercises, are you?
My team thought I was delightful.
So your team is keeping you, but the cooking school lady is not inviting you.
She was throwing me right out.
Apparently.
So. Luckily, it was about at this time that the buzzer rung, and we go to the next station, which was a fellow who was helping us make, I think it was blueberry or raspberry coulis. And so our portion of this was to put raspberries into a pan that he had heated and watch him shake it. So, again, didn't learn a whole lot at that stage.
But at least you avoided another confrontation.
Yeah, they didn't let me up front that time.
That's probably good. Yeah.
And then the following station was the pear station? I think it was the pear station. And so there was a pear and gorgonzola salad that we were supposed to prepare, and this was for ourselves. So now I was on my own finally to do as I wished because no one else would have to consume this but me. And so I said, pears sound good. Gorgonzola, I don't want any gorgonzola on my pears. So trying to be a, again, finger quotes, team player, I put all the gorgonzola in the middle of my bowl, and then I started lacing the pears around it so they wouldn't touch the gorgonzola instead of putting it under there and then lacing everything around. And I think there were some pine nuts that I also placed in my gorgonzola because I didn't want them. But I did have a lovely pear and truffle oil.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, to make the pear and gorgonzola salad the way you want it involves throwing the gorgonzola and the pine nuts in the trash.
I might have kept the pine nuts, but with the gorgonzola there, it just didn't seem like something I wanted.
Right.
And then we got to put maybe some truffle salt or something on there. It was a black truffle oil that we put on there, and then, I don't know, maybe it was pepper or something. There was, some other ingredient at the end. And then, oddly enough, we kind of nearly followed the course of the meal, so we ended up at dessert last. And dessert was sort of like a cobbler in a little, demitasse cup. And it was cobbler that I wouldn't have eaten. It was, like peaches and apples and some things that I just didn't think went together. And so they had already prepared that for us. And so the crumb layer was our responsibility. So they gave you a little bowl with some crumbs and butter. And you could put cinnamon or nutmeg or whatever you wanted in there. And some sugar, brown sugar. So, again, I didn't think they gave me enough butter. Because, a good crumb needs a lot of butter. But,
anything needs a lot of butter.
I ended up skimming off the crumb and eating that. I ate the pears off the side. And that was really the whole of my meal because the main course was a cooked salmon. And I love raw salmon, but I really don't enjoy cooked salmon. So I didn't eat the cooked salmon. And the mashed potatoes, ironically enough, Charles was sitting next to me at a table over, and he was like, "My God, these are so bland. I've never had such bland potatoes." And I took a bite of the potatoes and went, "Whoa, garlic." So apparently she extracted some amount of revenge upon my potatoes by putting the entire class's worth of garlic in my bowl.
And I would like to remind the listeners at this point that what we're talking about, in case you haven't been paying attention, is a team-building exercise. This sounds like a barbarian horde of anarchists.
Yes, well, yeah, it was an entertaining proposition. That was one of the things that I did to kill some time while I was in Seattle.
Well, your pink slip hasn't shown up in the mail yet, so I assume they decided to keep you.
Yeah, so far. But while I was doing that, I know we were scheduled to have an interview, which we have here, but I ended up having to do a different sort of interview during the interview. So while you were interviewing Amber, I was interviewing someone for our team who didn't get the job. But
too much garlic or not enough? I mean, what's the standard? What's a litmus test at Microsoft?
But you were able to pull off your interview with Amber, so I guess I'll let you walk that in.
Yes, well, first of all, when I'm doing pre-production by myself, it is an abysmal nightmare. It's the equivalent of putting, well, garlic and pine nuts in your gorgonzola salad. It did not go well. It took me 45 minutes just to figure out how everything worked. And then by the time Scott and Amber were ready, I had everything under control. And so they'll never know all the technical difficulties that might have torpedoed their interview. But Scott and Amber are coming on the show to talk about their the Four Paws Project.
F-O-U-R.
F-O-U-R.
P-A-W-S.
Because there are four authors who conspired to write a book, and the proceeds of the book are going to benefit an animal shelter. This week on the Sojcast, we have with us Amber Jerome Norgaard and Scott Morgan, who are two authors whose books I have read voraciously. While they are here in part to talk about that, our main interest is talking about Quillective and the Four Paws Project, which is their good deed for the day. So welcome, both of you. Thanks for coming on our show.
Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to get a little background for our listeners who, as you know, are primarily preoccupied with giant hamburgers and everything funny that comes out of my mouth. So since they may not know who you are, Amber, why don't you give me a little background? Because as far as I've been explaining to the folks at home, you were raised by a band of foul-mouthed pirates, which explains the...
No, I was actually raised by a... a fairly conservative Republican, very Catholic family. But there are certain members who are very much like me. And I guess it's my natural personality because everybody from my biological family is loud and just outrageous. So, yeah, no pirates. I apologize. I do dress up as one for Halloween with my kids occasionally.
Well, that's something. And tell me about how long, well, when did you start writing? You are both a poet and a novelist, right?
I guess. I've always written. It's always been something or the other. I fell in love with reading when I was maybe 5, 6. My father was always, always very much pushing me to read. So I've had this lifelong love affair with the written word. And in 9th grade, you know, we did a lot of creative writing, and on the last day, my teacher, Mrs. Lux, pulled me to the side and handed me a couple composition notebooks and told me, you need to write every day, even if it's just to say, I can't think of anything to write. So I've largely done that throughout my life, and it's, you know, it's always been poetry, or I write short stories, or I write about experiences that I've been through. So.
Okay, and the books that you have out now that are making the rounds on Amazon, the ones that I've read anyway, we've got the 4 a.m. collection, the 9:17, is it 9:17 a.m.?
Yes.
That's your most recent one.
Yes, 9:17 is my most recent.
And 11:59 p.m. So what's behind the times in the titles?
It started out, I'm kind of locked into it because the first book I put out was Color of Dawn, but I also liked the title In the Gloaming, which became, I think that was my 5th book I released. And so now it's just, I kind of like sticking with the time because there are certain times during the day that you find yourself, I don't know, I guess 4 a.m., for example, is when I've always had the most clarity, when I'm struggling with something, when I need to make a decision, or when I had a newborn that would not quit crying. It was, that would be the one time everything would settle. So now I'm kind of locked in. I like the idea. So that's pretty much your last it. Eventually I'll run out.
And I'm sure there's nothing ironic about the fact that strategically, 4 a.m. is the best time for a surprise attack on your enemy.
Well, I... Sure. If I had any enemies, I'd generally get along with everybody.
So. Yeah, I found that to be the case. And in addition to your books and story collections, you also do a podcast that we're acquainted with.
Yes, I do 2 podcasts.
Oh, 2 podcasts. Okay.
Yes, 2 podcasts. One is Tweep Nation, which is the one you're probably referencing with Dion Lister. And that's loosely related to Twitter, but it's mainly focusing on indie authors, and we get indie authors on there to promote their work and what they have coming up or what they've already put out. And Lyrical Versification podcast with Ben Dittmars is just based on poetry.
Okay. And you have a book coming out soon, Searching for Ellen.
Yes.
Which I guess I'm going to suggest, is that a departure from what you've written previously?
No, okay. Absolutely not, because it's autobiographical. It is about my search for my biological mother. It's kind of different as in usually my I cannot talk this morning. I apologize. My autobiographical essays, things like 4 a.m., 9:17 a.m., Beautiful Jewel. Those, they're taken from journal or blog entries. This is written from my experience searching for being adopted and searching for my biological mother, and I've been working on it total time from start to second draft finish when I sent it to Scott to be edited was 13 years and 2 days. And that will be coming out this September.
All right. And to in purposes of full disclosure, you and Scott have a pre-existing relationship. He's your editor, is that right?
Yes, he's my editor and good friend, and he actually holds the most visits on Tweep Nation, so he survived us 3 times.
Well, he must have been raised by pirates if that's the case.
Close enough.
Yes. So Scott, let's switch over to you. Now you are a recovering journalist, if I have that right, rehabilitated journalist,
yes.
Creative writing teacher, editor, and after reading your most recent book, you're quite a badass when it comes to motivational, getting writers to sit down and get back to work.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I don't know how to put it, but every time I start talking about writing or I try to teach people or something, there's always that sort of one starry-eyed person in my class or at a workshop or some kind of thing who just always has that kind of, they want to be Danielle Steele or they want to be Stephen King or they want to be Nora Roberts and they want to travel the world and make a lot of money. And that's you know, sincere, and they're very sincere. They're very heartfelt. They really want to write. They've always wanted to write. And then I tell them, well, yeah, but you know, you gotta work. I mean, people say, well, how do I get to where you are? Basically, they want my job is what they're trying to tell me. They want to run my company, you know, and I say, well, that's fine, but and they're like, well, how do you do it? And I said, well, you gotta get up, walk over to your computer and put it on. And then somewhere around 1 o'clock in the morning, you shut it off and go to bed. And, they're just kind of like, yeah, but I don't really want to do that. I just want to write. It's like, yeah, so do I, you know, but so they keep coming up with lots of reasons that they, they want to be writers, but they don't want to be writing professionals. And it just kind of gets on my nerves after a while. It just sort of like, shut the hell up and get to work. And if you put the work in, the work will come back to you, obviously. But
right.
I don't know how much of a badass I am. I'm just kind of tired of hearing people tell me how much they want, but everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to go to church. So, you know, it's.
Well, I just finished your latest book, and I'm still a bit emotionally fragile from it. So.
Oh, good.
So I'm gonna go with badass, but the book's title is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's How to Be a Whiny Biatch, 71 writing excuses meet the back of my hand.
Yep.
Essentially, and you may have read my one of my reviews of Amber's book said that she should be recruited by the Marines as a drill sergeant, and I'm thinking that the two of you together would be an unstoppable force in Paris Island. And here's why, because in both of your cases, you're not saying, well, I'm a badass and you should just do what I say. There's real compassion, there's real understanding in why we make these excuses. Because in your book, you talk about the excuses, you talk about where they come from and why people keep putting them up there. And the inevitable conclusion seems to be, no matter what your problem is, if you are passionate about writing and you want to do it for real, you have to get past the excuses and get to work.
Exactly. I'm so glad you said the word compassion, because, you know, it's kind of a big thing for me. It's always, it's funny. I don't necessarily know how I come off sometimes, because I mean, I grew up in New Jersey and I had four brothers and so three brothers and one fairly quiet sister, but I had three brothers and a loud mother, and you know, there's a lot of ball busting going on in my family and everything. So just, you know, it's kind of just how guys talk, where I'm used to just sort of, we bluster a lot. So I just kind of say things, you know, because I figure, well, there's no reason to mince words and, you know, whatnot. But I'm actually trying very hard to help people. I'm trying to get them past something, because and I could save you thousands of dollars in therapy. I know exactly what the therapist is going to tell you. The therapist is going to say, you have to get past yourself. You have to get over your things. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do. So basically, yeah, you can send me the thousands of dollars worth of checks that you were going to send to your therapist, because I'm telling you the same thing. I'm sort of giving you the truncated Wikipedia version of it. You know, just kind of get over your hang-ups and get back to work. But I am trying to be very, I don't want to say gentle about it, but definitely compassionate about it. I do understand where people are coming from, because I've used pretty much every one of those excuses that I have in the book. At some point, you look at yourself and you say, shut up, just get back to work. But, you know, but I've used them all. So I do understand where they're coming from. I no longer sympathize with them, but I do understand where they're coming from. So.
And like any kind of recovering, well, addict to anything, whether it's writing or say heroin, once you've gotten past the excuses, you can look back on them with some degree of clarity and say, yes, I know you're making that excuse, and I know how tough it is to have kids and work a job that's not what you love, but sooner or later, it is inevitable to just get down to business or give up, because those are your choices.
Right.
I got an email saying, look, I don't want to deal with promotions. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I just want to write. And his response was flat out, yeah, everybody has that complaint. Get back to work. Because, I mean, everybody has that complaint.
That's true.
Yes.
And nobody realized, I mean, I'm not one of those guys that's a black and white kind of a guy, but I, you're right. It does come down to the fact that you're either going to do it or you're not going to do it. And it's, you know, it's, there's really no other choice about it. You can't kind of write. Writing doesn't just kind of happen. You don't just kind of put the down and the rest of the sentence finishes itself. You have to, everything that a writer does. It's all action. It all happens because writers put their fingers on keys and start typing. And they keep typing until the whole story's done. And that's, you have to just do it. There's no other way to do it. It's, you know, you forget your keys upstairs and you have to walk back up the steps. You have to take all the steps yourself. Even if you skip a couple of steps, you have to go back upstairs. You have to just go and do it. So the good thing is this thing is apparently getting very good feedback. And a friend of mine, Greg Allen, just sent me a screen capture from, he was looking at the Washington Post, and Amazon had actually put an ad for that book in the Washington Post online. And I was just kind of like, yes. You know?
Yes.
So I don't know. I didn't pay for that. So that was great. You know, it's nothing like free advertising, but so I, you know, so at least the Washington Post thinks it's worth saying something about it, which I think is awesome.
It is awesome. How long does it take in your classes that you teach for your students to get it? And is there a percentage that you can tell on day one will just never get it?
Well, there's no blanket answer for that. When people do get it, they either get it right away, or it's that sort of slow dawning feeling of, you know, you left the keys upstairs and you're half a block down the street and you just kind of put your head back and go, ugh, and you realize you can't just magically summon your keys. You have to walk back. And there's that moment of just, and you're sort of trudging back and complaining under your breath. Yeah, I see that with some of the students. You know, my classes typically are 5 or 6 week, you know, non-credit classes. And, usually by week 2 or 3, they think, okay, you know, I'm getting somewhere. But there are occasionally 1 or 2 people that I know just, yeah, they're not going to get it. They're just sort of in fantasy land someplace. They, you know, they've married well, for example, and they don't really have any monetary consequences, and they want to, you know, they sort of want to dabble in writing, and they just, you know, and that's fine. I mean, if you just want to write and put your books out there and don't care if you sell them, that's great. But when people tell me that they want to be professional writers, and they tell me they want to be rich writers, they want to quit their jobs and buy yachts and stuff because of the money you sell from their books, I'm like, yes, so do I. You know, so it takes them longer to get through. On the other hand, there are certain people that I can tell from day one or day two that, yeah, they're going to do something about it. And I just actually finished about 2-3 weeks ago writing some recommendations for a young lady who was in one of my classes back in New Jersey, who is going to creative writing master's program, because she's, you know, she's finally so serious about doing it, she's going to just kind of go do it. And the fact that she's a lawyer already is, she's very a driven kind of a person like that. So she'll do it. And she's a very good writer. So she'll do it. But you can tell them, you can tell, okay, you get it. And the other people who are just kind of like, okay, no, I'm not going to really get this. And they bail on my class after like 4 sessions because, yeah, they just, they don't like, hearing that they have to keep working at it. And I don't really have any sympathy. So.
Or because it's too hard. You know,
Yeah.
One of the things I got from reading your book and, well, my conversations with Amber is it's something that may not occur to most people, but in order to be a successful writer, you have to be tough. Yes. And I think that that's something that most people don't expect. You know, you think of tough professions, firefighters, executive chefs, pirates, for example.
Yes.
Reverends.
Yes.
Reverends, right?
Yes. It's very hard doing my job.
And you
bless you, my child.
Thank you.
And you don't think that writers have to be tough as a boiled shoe.
Oh, my God. Yes, you do.
Well,
I so do.
Well,
oh, my God. Do you know how many close calls I had with having a mental breakdown writing Searching for Ellen? Because it wasn't just me writing. It was me putting, like, my blood, sweat, and literally tears in on writing that book. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to write this, crank it out. I mean, I literally, every word was a struggle to do it the correct way, to actually really put it out there to where it would be relevant to people, that it would have some effect in a positive manner.
And I got to say that Searching for Ellen is definitely the piece that may have wrung you out emotionally, but having read 917 most recently, I think your soul is still on the page. I get a sense there's a lot of emotional, mental, intellectual effort behind what goes into your writing, which is why I picked that book up. I bought it when you announced it on Facebook, and I spent the next 2 to 3 hours doing nothing else except reading this book. So it's hard, but it works, and I think that's good. I guess the final point, when I was very young, I took a creative writing class with a very mean lady named Evelyn Wild Mayerson. And she actually had been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, and she taught a creative writing class that I got into. And the first day, she had us give a writing sample, and everybody in the room, she basically said, this right here, it's a piece of shit. And I was like, oh my God, you're a monster. You're so mean. What is wrong with you? But by the end of her class, I kind of got it. You have to be tough. You have to be willing to throw away what you think is great in hopes of making it better. So let's talk about your good deed for the year, the Four Paws Project and Collective.
Okay.
Yes. Collective will be my good deed for the rest of my life, actually, because I'm planning on doing this yearly, where we pick a nonprofit organization and get a couple of authors. It won't always be poetry. You know, it may be short story fiction, or it may be a collection of essays.
Well, that's good, because I hear Scott doesn't like poetry all that much.
Yeah. And he's one of the...
Where'd you hear that?
On a podcast.
Tell me that all the time. But, no, it's... the idea actually started Rob Zimmerman. You know, he asked me, do you want, probably back in November, he said, would you like to do a collaboration with me? You know, do out around Christmas. So I said, that'd be a great idea. And he mentioned, you know, well, maybe we should get Ben Dittmars in on it. And I said, oh, great, because I absolutely adore Ben. I love his work. I mean, he's just absolutely brilliant. And, you know, I kind of mentioned the project to Scott. And he goes, well, you know, as much as I hate poetry, I've got a couple, you know, I'd like to put in there. And I said, oh, okay, great. So, you know, it's the four of us. And then Ben mentioned, since we're releasing it around Christmas, maybe all the proceeds should go to a charity. And all of a sudden we have this idea, let's pick an organization, put this book out just for them. And the one we ended up going with is the Dallas Humane Society No-Kill Shelter Dogs in Kitty City, which is just absolutely awesome. I've been by there, fell in love probably about 75 times with the animals that they have there. I mean, just, oh my God, they're so sweet. One of them tried to eat my purse, which was just awesome. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, we're doing something that long after I'm gone, as long as this organization is still there, they can benefit from this. Because, you know, the written word is eternal. I mean, it's not going to go anywhere. Look at the books that people read. Yeah, I mean, the Iliad and the Odyssey. You want to talk about poetry books that hang around for ages and ages and ages, that's a prime example.
And so who are your partners in crime on this? Rob Zimmerman, Ben Dittmars, and Scott?
Scott and Russell Blake, who I have just a huge fan of ever since he broke onto the indie scene. I mean, so much so I used to write tweets advertising his books because I just love his work. I asked him, since he does a lot of work with shelters down in Mexico where he lives, I said, you know, would you mind writing a foreword? And he said, I don't like poetry. You know, I hate it. And I'm like, yeah, I know, but, you know, write the foreword, please. And he said, okay. So, you know, he wrote this unbelievably beautiful foreword for the book. And Chris Morton, you also probably know her as Cabin Goddess, is doing promotions on this and getting us, you know, ready to go with like blog tours and tweets and things like that. So.
Oh, and I was going to tweet something too, but so far all I've got is a bunch of people who don't like poetry wrote a book of poetry.
Yes, but I adore poetry, obviously, because, you know, I do a podcast on it once a week. But I mean, for me, I used to be very involved musically. You know, I played piano, I was in the band, you know, I sang in a band with my cousins, I, this, that, and the other, you know, I would perform at karaoke very loudly, very good, but loudly. And for me, music is like kind of a offset because any musical lyrics are just another form of poetry.
Okay. So we're going to put links on our website for all of your literary works. Scott, your Right Hook company for aspiring writers out there.
Thank you.
Everything else to do with you guys. Did you want to, hold on, I had a thought and lost it and I can't. So, let's move on if you are interested to the favorite part of our podcast, which is food porn. Yes. Yes. So, tell me what you've got.
Baked potato soup.
Really?
Which I no longer eat. I will never have it again. I had my last little fling with it in early January. And there is nothing in there. There's one thing in there that's good for you, and that is green onions. The rest of it, it is. I mean, you want to talk about the word foodgasm. That is what this stuff is. And I mean, it's all, it could basically give you a heart attack in like one bite. I mean, it's, oh my God, it's so incredible. But alas, I'm switching to veganism and I will never again eat it.
I was gonna ask about that. You know, what is the nature of your breakup with potato soup? Did you find it cheating on you with a salad or something? But
no. And I love salad. That's the thing. I'm a big, big, love to eat salad, but, now I'm switching to veganism because for health reasons, and I noticed, you know, last summer there was a weekend where all I ate was at vegan restaurants, and I felt much, much better, much more healthier, and you know, losing weight from it, which is a good thing. And
in this venue, veganism is the cold shower of foodborne. But we'll set that aside. This baked potato soup that you lament, is this something you make yourself or do you get it somewhere locally?
Either or. I make a killer, I make a killer baked potato soup.
Well, we're going to want the recipe so we can try it ourselves.
You know what? I will email it to you when we get done recording. It is just absolutely incredible. I mean, there's whole milk, butter, sour cream, bacon, cheese. I mean, it's God.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just, oh my God.
That right there is some classic food porn. That's exactly what we're looking for. So I'm glad you've been paying attention. And so, Scott, let's talk about your food porn. I assume that you sit around in your throne of skulls drinking the blood of your enemies, but perhaps you've got something else.
Yeah, no, the blood thing is just Friday nights. I mean, you got to unwind, but,
you and Francois knocking back some flagons of enemy blood.
Yeah, that's the stuff. The trouble with that is I'm already vegan. I've been for a long time. And, one of the things I miss both for veganism and because my mother died a few years ago is my mother's rice pudding. She used to make this really simple rice pudding that was just, I mean, and I could smell it. I mean, I live a couple of miles away from her. As an adult, and it was just kind of one of those things, you know, like, you know, the monkeys get alerted to the scent of an enemy just somewhere, you know, off on the Serengeti, and it's like the whole tree's full of monkeys go, and they just kind of, yeah. That was, as soon as this stuff went in the oven, it was just kind of like, I think I'm going to go see mom. And it was just, yeah, oh my God, it was so good. It was pretty much just milk, sugar, and rice and some little vanilla, but I mean, she used to make this huge pan of it, and it was one of those things that, as soon as it went in the oven, like everybody in my family just kind of descended upon my mother's house, that we just knew that she was making rice pudding. And me, I'm like the runt in my family. My brother Tommy was this big giant guy. And yeah, we sort of, you know, I had to sort of get past his fat ass to get into the kitchen to get a bowl of it. Otherwise he'd eat the whole damn thing. So, you know,
but I don't think I have ever heard you use the expression fat ass before.
Yeah. No, he didn't really have, he kind of did, but still, he was in my way, and he was in the way to the rice pudding, but I missed, is the only thing my mother made that was any good, really, was rice pudding and vegetable soup. She was a terrible cook, but the rice pudding, oh my God, did she make such, I don't know what she did with it. It was just the three or four ingredients. It was just rich and lush, you know? It's just kind of one of those things you put in your mouth, you go, yeah. And it was, yeah, it was totally,
I'm finding out that vegans are surprisingly good at food porn, from listening to two of you talk. So tell me something then. What's food porn for you guys? What do you do to make veganism exciting, interesting, and a little dirty?
Yeah, the thing to do with veganism is to find fat substitutes, essentially, that taste as good as, you know, animal fats and, there are a couple of, they're referred to as vegan butters, not so much margarines because they're made a little differently than margarine. They're not just sort of, you know, puffed up like, you know, bad for you oils or something. They're actually like essential oil blends or something. But, you know, if you find certain things like that or, you know, vegan sour creams or, you know, things like vegan, vegan milks like almond milks or almond creams that have been sort of thickened up and whipped and stuff like that. You can make some killer stuff with that stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. I've made chocolate. Matter of fact, I just bought some chocolate chunks yesterday. I'm going to make some chocolate chip cookies because I've been dying for them. But you don't, and it's funny because people always ask me, it's like, well, how do you do it without the eggs? And it's like, I just don't put the eggs in it. You know, and it's like, that's
oh,
it.
Oh, is you that know? How you do it?
It's like, that's pretty much it. Yeah. You just sort of substitute a couple of things. You know, you use canola oil instead of eggs, you know, or something. Or whatnot, but if you know how to do it, and particularly if you are a sugar head like me, and you know you pretty much just kind of take a tub of butter and whip it up with a cup of sugar and just turn it into just something that's horrible for you. I mean, I think the number one thing that people think about vegans is that we're all really healthy, and I have a really crappy diet despite the fact that I'm a vegan. I'm all about like potato chips and Oreos. I mean, Oreos are actually vegan, so it's, you know, I mean, I could eat a whole bag of those at once, but. You know, pancakes and cupcakes and cookies and You know, stuff like that. It just, yeah, I have actually not a very good, I'm sitting here, I'm trying to eat an orange. I bought a bag of clementines at the store yesterday and I've been trying to eat this thing and I'm just like, man, it's like, I just want some, you know, now Amber says about strawberry cake. I just kind of want some strawberry icing on it or something. It just, like,
there goes my diet for the day.
Yes.
you people should talk. I'm sitting across the street from the best burger place in the world.
But they have a vegan burger there. That's what's awesome.
Oh, did they? I didn't even
know. Yes. They do, because I look, because he's like going on, and then he mentioned in his interview that, yes, I do listen to your show, Stacey.
That's good to know. That's and you can you tell me apart from Mark or not?
I might be able to. But no, he mentioned that his best friend is vegan, so he got the recipe for a really killer vegan burger. And I'm like, I gotta go there, like, now. But, I mean, there's a Chinese buffet here that had, it's all vegan. And I could not tell the difference between, you know, regular sesame chicken and their version of it. And I just sat there. I mean, I actually went back for seconds, which I don't do. I'm kind of a grazer. I eat smaller meals throughout the day. But it was like, I just sat there and like inhaled the stuff. Oh my God, it was so good. I may have to go there for lunch.
Is this food porn thing supposed to be making me like really just like ravenously hungry?
I know.
And kind of want to strip off my clothes and just dive into a vat of like chocolate sauce or something.
That's exactly what we had in mind.
Excellent. And then mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
You know, I am working on a new erotica short story, Stacey. I have to put in food in there because I'm like, oh, I got to eat again.
See, now all my tweets about this particular episode are going to start with, vegans talking food porn. No, no, wait, seriously. I'm not kidding. No, it's good. You should listen.
You know what's funny is a small confession time here. Like one of the original, where I said I had three short story collections out before I repackaged my my stuff. One of them was a book. It was more written toward the sort of, it was called Love, Sex, Soul. It was about sort of adult look at things. It wasn't quite an erotica book, but it was, it had sort of, you know, just sort of the kind of sexuality behind it. And actually, yes, my descriptions of just being sort of rapturously in love with something actually were based in what I feel about food, not really about people. So, confession time.
Doesn't like poetry, not very fond of people either. I'm making a list here, Scott.
Yeah.
It's all going to be in my report.
Please don't tell Santa Claus, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the comical thing, as much as he does not like poetry, is that's what he gets for me to look over to make sure it's correct more often than not.
Someone's got to do it.
Yes.
Scott, one last thing. Your company, again, Right Hook, do I have that right? Right for the jugular? Jugular?
Yes. Right for the jugular, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to want links for all that as well. To put up on our website so that we can advertise your services.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Reverend Amber, would you like to send us out with a blessing, perhaps? I've got my vodka right here.
You put me on the spot like this, man. I need preparation time.
Oh, don't worry. You'll be on this little show again because we've got big plans for you, Missy. So,
alright, fine. Blessed be the readers, for you are why I write.
There you go. See, that was quite,
I like that.
Well, thanks again, Amber Jerome Norgard and Scott Morgan, for being on our show and talking about all your various projects, your weirdo vegan food porn, and the Four Paws Project. And we'll have links to all that on our website. We would be very interested to know how that works out.
One more thing, Stacey. Whoever put the bet down that I would not drop the F-bomb once, you won.
I did.
Indeed.
Whoever put that bet I know. Isn't it amazing that I can actually behave myself on occasion?
All right. I'm composing another tweet. Reverend Amber exhibits legendary control on the air. Who knew it was possible?
I've done it before.
I know. Okay, guys. Well, thanks again.
Nice talking to you.
And that was our interview with Amber and Scott. Now on to everyone's favorite, food porn.
As part of our pursuit to find good local cuisine in the Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati area, we decided to, this week, tackle Chinese.
In the street.
In the street.
There's one now. Get him.
Knock them down and put them in bags and throw the bags in the trunk. But there is a restaurant called Sichuan Garden.
Which has been mentioned on this Sojcast before, but not by us.
Not by us. By our local imported devotee of food porn, Mike Harwood, also known as Whackburger Guy.
Yes, the owner of Whackburger was, well, I don't know if he turned us on to this, but I know I had never been there before. I've seen it a bunch of times, but I'd never gone. I don't know if you had gone.
We had had them bring food to the house because, as you know, we don't really often go places, but if people will bring us food, we'll sit around and wait for them to show up with it. So,
and we did think that was somewhat interesting, sitting at the Chinese restaurant going, why is it that some genres of food, we expect delivery? Pizza, right. Better deliver. Gosh darn it. Chinese food, better deliver.
Yes.
Sushi, I have no such expectation. And it's also right. Asian. What's the deal there?
Well, and like Montgomery Inn barbecue ribs, they're not going to bring them to your house.
No.
Burgers
don't come to your house. It's just odd. Well, anyway.
And by the way, Mike, if you're listening, Whackburger delivery, really just to one location. I mean, you don't have to expand it out to all the rest of your customers, but if you could send them across the street,
that'd be good.
That's all we care about. So after our brief divergence into why is it that Chinese and pizza tends to deliver, but most other kinds of food don't, cause we didn't really come up with an answer, we ordered Sichuan Garden.
Yes. And we, for an appetizer, we had lettuce wraps, which many people have experienced at places like the Cheesecake Factory or California Pizza Kitchen or whatever,
P.F. Chang's.
Yeah, P.F. Chang's. A number of pieces of lettuce from an iceberg lettuce.
Yes.
And a
big leaf.
And a minced chicken thing. And we also had some pot stickers, I believe.
Yeah.
Dumplings.
They call them fried dumplings. Yes. But there's, fried dumpling with pork and vegetables on the inside and some sort of dipping sauce.
A red, spicy, soy-y sort of sauce.
It was quite good on the dumplings.
It was good on the dumplings. And the chicken, lettuce wraps, there was lemon, I should say, cooked up in the chicken.
Yes, which was
like
very
we could have eaten it. I didn't because I don't know why, but there was only one that I wanted to share.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a good opening volley, I thought. And then for lunch, there was, the General Tso's chicken.
Which, I gotta say that General Tso's chicken is one of the litmus tests of a Chinese restaurant, in my opinion.
Well yeah, and it's a wacky litmus test, but you're right. I mean, there's so much variation in what the General's sauce was like. So, you know, they're all generally reddish sauces, I guess that much is common.
And they can be spicy. There's a place I know that would put black hot peppers in them. Yeah. And you have to watch out for those.
And, and it's a batter fried chicken if you've never had it. So it's a piece of chicken, batter fried, or battered, deep fried, and then with some sort of red sauce upon it.
Right. And with broccoli usually.
Oh yeah, it's sometimes a vegetable. So yeah, that was the course I ordered and you ordered.
I ordered something called Hong Kong steak.
Hong Kong steak. I was in Hong Kong. I never had that steak, but it looked good.
It was, it was some sort of tenderloin sliced up with a bunch of vegetables because lately I've been missing vegetables somehow in my diet, probably from not eating them. And I'm thinking to recompense by eating vegetables at every opportunity. So this was one of those things that had a hunk of meat and a bunch of vegetables and a really weird looking sauce. Was it yellow?
It was yellow.
It was yellow sauce, and
a little bit spicy.
Yeah, but it was good.
And there was what we thought was a radish rose, but upon further inspection, we believe it was a bok choy rose.
Yes.
Which I don't think I've ever seen. It was the root, the stump, what do you call that? The neck, the part of the bok choy where all the leaves are held together. Much like like a cabbage. And it was that, I forget, there's a technical term for that. I can't remember it now, but. It was that.
This is why we have a comment section at the end of our Sojcast page for people to fill in the information that we lack.
Yeah, or the ability to edit. But yeah, they took the thick part of that and then just cut it up so it was a rose and opened up, and it was quite impressive.
It was visually impressive, and you know, but because it was bok choy, it tasted like, well, crunchy nothing.
Yeah, crunchy nothing is good. It's fiber.
Right. So
we've got pictures of those. We'll include them in on the webpage so that you can see what those look like.
Right. But I think we came away from this meal, and also we had fried rice, which was
The fried rice was pretty good. It was a plain fried rice. I mean, it was fried rice with nothing
in it.
Nothing at all.
But it was good, and so I think we came away from this lunch thinking that Sichuan Garden is probably the best Chinese food that we've had
in the area. Yeah.
In the area so far.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've been disappointed by most of the Chinese places in the area because they cater, I think, more to the Midwest than we would care for them to.
Which means less authentic,
much less authentic
flavors. You know, they try and hold back on the spices.
If you go, for example, if you go to a buffet, Chinese restaurant that has a buffet here, you will almost certainly find cheese pizza, macaroni and cheese. I'm trying to think what else. Yeast rolls. Things you don't expect to see in Chinese
restaurant. And some sort of, like, roast of beef.
Yeah, well, yeah, a roasted beef. So, yeah, that's not exactly what we think of, you know. Macaroni and cheese and pizza are not what we think of when we think of Chinese.
Right.
But anyway, this was a nice turn for the better. So we're encouraged by that, and we approve of Mike's selection in the Sichuan Garden. And I also, before I returned home, I ended up eating Chinese at a place called Spicy Talk, which sounds like, you know, a Mexican 3G wireless plant or something. It's not exactly what I associated with a Chinese restaurant, but it was a hole-in-the-wall Chinese restaurant that it was another team outing. We went to lunch together, and this was much more team building because it was a family style, so a giant Lazy Susan on the table. You spun it around, and everybody could get bowls and things off there. And this was the best Chinese food I'd had outside of Asia. It was phenomenally authentic. And they called it crispy chicken. I think it was Sichuan crispy chicken and Mandarin crispy chicken were the two varieties. And they were like a General Tso's chicken. So it was the same basic thing. It was a red sauce, but theirs had spices that you just realized as soon as you bit it, like, I don't know where that came from. Like, I cannot find that at the grocery store. That's not from here. We also had dumplings. It was a very similar meal, in fact. So there was dumplings to open with, and they were mind-bogglingly good. Just to the point where polite society, you know, has people staring at each other going, you better take that last one or I'm going to fight you for it. You know, it was awfully good stuff. I'm trying to think what else. There was a number of other things that was really good. I mean, they had Mongolian beef that was excellent. They did some lo mein, Hong Kong noodles, all kinds of stuff. That was just phenomenal.
And the whole thing was family style. They just put a bunch of it down on the table and you just pass it around.
Yeah, in fact, it was so good that Suzanne came up to Redmond for a few days. And when she was there, I insisted on taking her, and, well, we basically ordered enough for a family just because I didn't want her to miss any of the dishes.
Well, see, and I've had that, I had that thought today also, in which you want to go to, there are some restaurants where you want to go to and eat like a food critic. You know,
yes.
give me your most popular dish and then eight or nine other things.
Yes.
And I'm going to sample from each one of them to get an overall sense of your restaurant.
Yeah, and so luckily, you know, we did that with the team, and our boss, who took us there, had been there a number of times, so she ordered for us and did marvelously. So everything that she ordered, or nearly everything she ordered, I duplicated for just two of us instead of 10. So needless to say, we had a fair bit of leftover, and we took that back to the hotel, and the next day, when I went back to Microsoft to work and to eat anywhere in Seattle that I wanted, I was secretly jealous that I wasn't eating the cold leftovers Suzanne got to enjoy. So,
but you're not bitter. Very mature.
There was plenty to go around. But yeah, I think she would agree if she were here to tell you that it was the best Chinese she had in a darn long time, maybe ever. So there you have it. Spicy Talk in Redmond, Washington, and Sichuan Garden in, I want to say, Covington.
I think it's technically Park Hills, but we'll call it Covington.
It's halfway up the hill, yeah. It's not too far.
I think they'll deliver here, so let's keep that in mind.
We'll link to it so that you know exactly where they are if you ever happen to be in Washington or the greater Cincinnati area.
Yes. So that brings us to the end of Sojcast number 20.
Our 20th ever Sojcast.
Sponsored by Strange Voices.
the makers of Being Committed to a Mental Institution, Sudden Real Estate Listings,
and Emasculated Ducks.
And so that's it for now. We'll see you next time, unless, of course, the world is destroyed.